response to the report, Lanier tweeted, "Stop gaslighting us, Harvard." She also tweeted, "If Harvard truly embraced the principles in their report, the Lanier versus Harvard lawsuit would not be necessary." We spoke to Tamara Lanier in 2019 about her lawsuit.
Last week, my attorneys and I filed a claim against Harvard. I'm asking for the return of my enslaved ancestors' images. And the complaint is more than just a complaint about images. It's a history lesson. And specifically, it points to the exploitation of slaves and how universities like Harvard continue to profit.
If you can comment on what Tamara Lanier is calling for, and also the recommendations of the report, like working with historically black colleges and universities, Professor Wilder.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the striking elements of the report is the acknowledgement of the length of Harvard's ties to slavery, which, again, I think you can find something very similar for most of our elite educational institutions. Harvard's ties to slavery begin really with its founding in 1636, but they continue after the end of slavery in Massachusetts, roughly 1783. They continue right up until the Civil War. What's striking is that even after the Civil War, Harvard continues to have ties to slavery, because slavery still exists in places like Cuba and Brazil, and universities are actively actually pursuing those unfree economies as sites for profiteering. One of the things I had written in my book is that in the 18th and 19th century, you could actually judge the value or the prominence of a university by its collection of human remains. Universities and colleges actively collected human beings and samples of human beings. It was part of the evolution of science, and particularly a part of the evolution of the race science that drove the scientific revolution. And so what's happening currently in this lawsuit also involves what the report lays out as the thousands of remains of human beings that are currently held in the Harvard museums. Thousands. Most of those remains are likely of Native Americans. They've identified, I believe, 15 that are enslaved Africans. One can, again, go across by university and see the way in which actually the 19th century and 18th century legacy of race science continues to play out on our campuses. And we literally live with the bodies of enslaved people and the bodies of indigenous people who were consumed in the process of building our institutions, not just in the cemeteries, but also in the museums and the libraries. They're there. To come to the recommendations, I think the recommendations include a number of things, including actually building on the Georgetown example, establishing relationships to descendant communities, Native and African and of African descent, memorializing and continuing to do research on Harvard's ties to slavery and the legacy of slavery at Harvard, reaching out to historically black colleges and universities to establish educational partnerships, creating a legacy of slavery fund, an endowment, the $100 million, to fund all of these promises, and then promising some long-term institutional accountability on these questions.
MIT history professor Craig Stephen Wilder long followed the issue of slavery, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And that does it for our Juneteenth special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with public intellectual Henry Giroux, who is a professor and author and one of the most important political theorists of our day.
Henry has a profound political analysis of the meaning of the January 6th House hearings. We talk to him about fascism and how to fight it. In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we have a special place for attorney and professor Holly McGuigan.
Holly is a criminal defense attorney. You'll not just like her, you'll love her. And her storytelling, like every defense lawyer, is beyond belief.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Law and Disorder Radio was launched 18 years ago by four lawyers for the purpose of defending democracy and the rule of law. This was just after the United States attacked Iraq under the false pretense that Iraq harbored weapons of mass destruction. We have seen democracy and the rule of law consistently disintegrating. Starting perhaps 40 years ago under the Reagan administration, this disintegration has brought us to the crisis of today. A committee of the House of Representatives is actually holding televised hearings on the attempted coup d'etat by the last president, Donald Trump. At the first hearing, it was demonstrated that Trump planned to ignore the results of an election which he had lost by 7 million votes. The insurrection that he initiated was unsuccessful. The Capitol was attacked after Trump incited the insurrectionists, and Trump did nothing to stop it for over 3 hours. When Vice President Mike Pence refused to go along with Trump's scheme to overthrow the election results, Trump suggested that hanging Pence was a good idea. The insurrectionists had built a gallows on the grounds of the Capitol. What has brought us to this crucial point? We live in a country where inequality is increasing, where, as Bob Dylan wrote, money doesn't talk, it swears. Nearly half the population is poor or near poor. Neoliberalism, an extreme form of capitalism, has taken hold and hollowed out the country. Schools have been privatized, and there is no national health care system. Students are $1.7 trillion in debt, just as a result of attending college. The country's infrastructure is crumbling. There's no decent railroad service. There are mass shootings almost every day, and the U.S. government is spending $813 billion on war this year. The United States refuses to help negotiate a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine. The twin threats of nuclear war and climate catastrophe hang over our heads. Things are dreadful. We've reached a point summarized by the great Italian revolutionary Antonio Gramsci, who was imprisoned by a fascist dictator. Gramsci famously wrote from his prison cell, quote, "The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters," end quote. We speak today with public intellectual Henry Giroux. He's a professor at McMaster University in Canada and the author of some 60 books, including America on the Edge. Professor Henry Giroux, welcome to Law and Disorder. I should say welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. And Michael, Henry is fine for me.
What was your initial reaction to the televised hearings on the January 6th insurrection?
My initial reactions were complicated because at one level, I think it does a number of things that are important. It examines the broader campaign to deny essentially what you might call the will of the people. It doesn't just focus on the insurrection. It focuses more specifically on what it calls a coup. I think it establishes an historical record in some way and points to the dangers of the far right. And, of course, it sort of highlights in some ways how the GOP has been captured by, you know, the forces of extremism. And it reminds us of how violent the election was. The insurrection was. And it makes clear that the threat is current. But I mean, outside of that, you know, there's the fundamental question of, you know, what it leaves out, and also the question of how purposeful it'll be in changing anything. Unlike my friend Chris Hedges, I'm not willing to dismiss this as purely spectacle. I think there's a pedagogical moment here that can be used and seized. But I just don't think, of course, it goes far enough. We're not talking about capitalism. We're talking about one particular incident. It doesn't really lay the groundwork for, in a fundamental way, for the various forces that are really attacking democracy in a way that's dreadful and points to what I call fascism.
Henry, what is the case against Donald Trump that is being laid out in these hearings?
Well, I think the case is that, you know, he's committed conspiracy. He's a liar. He's aligned himself with right-wing extremists. He's corrupt, as is evident by the money that was sent in to, you know, reinforce the big lie and is now being probably spent by him and his children. There's also the case that this is, you know, a very serious issue, because it's about the overthrow of the American government. What I think the committee is doing is laying the groundwork to move the Justice Department to basically charge these people, Trump and his moronic allies, with criminal charges. And I'm hoping, you know, that will be the case.
Do you think that the committee has presented anything new? You know, the committee has no prosecutorial power, but it can make a criminal referral to the Attorney General Garland. Do you think the hearings will help convince Garland to indict Trump?
I hope so. I mean, you know, when Garland now appears on the news, he seems to suggest that he's watching as much as he can and that his department is watching it consistently. And so I think that what Garland is really watching is public opinion and how that moves and might give him the leeway to actually take some action against, you know, against the criminal conspiracists. As far as something new, I think that what I think is new and what I like in terms of the argument, maybe not new in terms of people not knowing about it, but the way in which they have allowed those people who are actually aligned with Trump to indict him, that's very convincing, because I think in some fundamental way it completely explodes and throws out the window the arguments that these other Republicans are making, you know, the neo-fascists, claiming that this is all spectacle, it's one-sided, it's biased. It offers something that's interesting and persuasive.
Richard Donahue, the acting deputy attorney general, testified that he told Donald Trump that each one of the voter fraud claims were false. Trump's answer, according to Donahue, was, quote, he accepted that and said, okay, fine. So that would seem to indicate that everything that Trump did afterwards, he knowingly lied.
I think that what's even worse is that there was a report, I believe I read in The Guardian, tweeted, and on his whatever platform he's using now, he made the claim that this was really a great moment in American democracy. I mean, he not only knows he lies, and he's well aware of that, but the claim that this attempted coup was something that should be celebrated suggests that he really is a criminal of unparalleled significance, it seems to me, in American history, at least a criminal in terms of somebody who occupies the position of the President of the United States.
Henry, it's interesting you should say that, because it reminds me of that old phrase, when you're being run out of town, get in front of the crowd and make it look like you're leading the parade. And that's what Trump does. That's kind of his specialty. What is the strategy of the Republicans here? Fox News didn't even carry a live feed to the first hearing, although they did cover the second one, probably as a result of ratings. How is the right wing spinning the hearings?
Well, I think, Marjorie, what I see here is something I've been writing about for a long time. And I think that what the Republican Party has done ever since the Powell memo is that they are so keen and aware of the power of the media to basically distort and divide and to lie and to basically cover up and to create absences and not talk about issues that matter, but to engage in the spectacularization of politics. That's their strategy. They really know how to do that. I mean, of course, one doesn't want to underplay the concentration of power that they have over the media in cahoots with particular elements of the financial elite, particularly the Murdoch family and some of the major corporations. But they know how to lead the media. They realize that education is fundamentally central to politics, and they have an enormous understanding of what broader cultural forces are in American society, if not across the globe, that have an educational weight unlike anything we have seen before, whether we're talking about the new media, the social media. But this interrelationship between power, everyday life, and the new technologies is really a political atom bomb. and they have seized on that. And that's their mechanism, and the strategy is to lie, spectacularize, and deny.
Do you think that's why a large number of American people believe that Biden stole the election? Is that the explanation?
I think that the real issue here is to what degree has their attempt to produce a mass form of manufactured ignorance works. And I think it works. I mean, whether you're talking, I mean, all the institutions that matter, in it seems to me, in any democracy, whether we're talking about education or we're talking about the criminal justice system or we're talking about the social media, I mean, those institutions that basically provide a public space to educate people in some fundamental way to make sure that an informed public is able to sustain a democratic society have withered. You know, over the last, since the 1970s, the late 1970s, those public spaces, those democratic institutions have been under siege. And now we're seeing the result of that. What we're seeing is people who can no longer discern between truth and lies, an education system that's being privatized, a rabid attack on education from people like DeSantis and Abbott and others, because they understand something. They understand that ideas are dangerous, and they understand that history is dangerous. And they understand that they have a media, control of a media, in which they can push that line endlessly. And I think basically it works.
Henry, you have written, and I quote, "The brutalizing horrors of a fascist past are with us once again. This is most evident in the growing support for bigotry and white nationalism among Republicans and their base, buttressed by the increased presence of armed militia and an increasingly well-armed populace," unquote. What role do you think Trump played in validating white supremacy?
I think what he did was, right from the beginning, when and long before he came down the escalator announcing that Mexicans and other undocumented immigrants were basically rapists, criminals, and carriers of disease, I think he embraced, and through a language of dehumanization, through a language of racism, elements of white supremacy that not only basically undermined what I would call the shared hopes and dreams and values that are central to democracy by replacing them with shared fears, but basically he mobilized a different element and a different base for the Republican Party. And this is an endpoint. I mean, he's just symptomatic of something that clearly had been going on for a long time, beginning with genocide of Native Americans, slavery, the Jim Crow period, the internment of Japanese. But he did something different. He took white supremacy, and rather than allow it to hide in the shadows through dog whistles, he basically produced it as a badge of honor. And it worked for him. It mobilized the most extreme elements of the Republican Party. He then used the media to intimidate those people who didn't buy into both the big lie and the elements of white supremacy, the elements, particularly the claims to racial purity and white replacement theory. And I think it basically it worked. Those elements were aggressive. They're now moving from the fringes of society and talking about violence to electing themselves on school boards and trying to undermine the process by appropriating the very elements that make it work in some ways. And so he's a pathbreaker, it seems to me. He's a demagogue for the new age.
Henry, the Republican Party is different than the old one. What's the base, and why is it so popular?
It's different from the old one because, basically, it parades in a corruption that it's turned into a badge of honor. It has no ethical sensibilities whatsoever. It basically is a white supremacist party. It aligns itself with dictators. It sees Hungary as a model that basically speaks to how the future should be canceled out in terms of any sort of democratic values or rights. It believes in a liberal democracy, and it has an army of spokespersons, whether in the media or in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, who basically support that line. And so it seems to me this is a Republican Party that very blatantly not only holds up the banner of racism and white supremacy, but has an enormous contempt for democracy. It did something that I never anticipated coming out of the 60s myself could happen. It took the neoliberal notion that you can separate economic activity from social cost. In other words, you can bury the question of social responsibility. And it added a new level to it, and that was an embrace of fascist politics.
Kevin Phillips, President Reagan's speechwriter, said at that time that the Democratic Party was the capitalists' second favorite party, Do you think that's still true?
Of course it's true. This is the party of Wall Street. I mean, you know, as my friend Chris Hedges has said repeatedly, you know, this is not a party that is criticizing capitalism. It's not a party that's criticizing militarism. It's not a party that's criticizing poverty and staggering inequality. It's not a party that's arguing for ecological rights. It's a party that's saying, hey, look, we have to ward off extremist elements because in a fundamental way, what we don't want to do is expose how awful capitalism actually is. I mean, the notion that you can't look at fascism unless you examine capitalism has never been more true, especially since neoliberal capitalism has failed. It can't live up to its promises anymore of equality, social mobility, meritocracy. This stuff is all nonsense now. Collapsed in 2008 with the financial crisis. And so now, instead of making a claim that it can do those things, it aligns itself with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and basically one operates with what I call fast violence. And the fast violence is that it says blacks, people of color, immigrants are the problem. The slow violence is you simply never talk about what the problems really are, while allowing those problems to continue, and yet speaking in a democratic language that is utterly empty and has no possibility for changing anything.
Henry, the extreme inequality in the United States is the result of a neoliberal economic policy. Neoliberals, as we know, started out with Ronald Reagan and continued with Clinton, and they paved the way for Trump. The forces aligned with Trump have put our democratic institutions under attack, as you've explained, in order to protect the rule of the wealthy. Those attacks include the right to vote, labor unions, public education, independent news media, independent public universities, the privatization of much of traditional governmental functions, and then making it almost impossible for us to launch a new political party. Where do the responsibilities for these attacks lie?
I think they lie in the emergence of a counter-revolution that began basically in the 1970s. And I think that what we saw in the 1970s was the consolidation of a neoliberal movement, a financial elite, that basically consolidated power in their hands in order to roll back any fundamental attempt to revive the language of democracy across a whole range of issues, from universities to politics itself, that scared them to death. And I think we haven't seen the end of that. And so the question of responsibility, I think, is twofold. One is you have to be able to identify the power relations at work in this sort of anti-capitalist juggernaut, which I call neoliberal fascism. And I think you have to talk about the responsibility of intellectuals, academics, social movements, to be able to make power visible so it can be understood and attacked, but also to create collective movements of resistance that are not siloed, that are not fragmented. We need a new language here, and we need a language that understands what happened to political agency. What happened to the death of agency? What happened with the emergence of civic illiteracy? What happened with particular forms of manufactured ignorance? What are the forces behind that? And what can we do to begin to address them in a language in which capitalism per se never becomes an element that we claim needs to be reformed? It needs to be eliminated. So we need a new language of social justice. We need a new language. We need a language that brings together political rights, social rights, and economic rights. Those rights without economic rights just simply don't work. Who cares if you can vote, if you vote or not, when you're choosing between food and drugs? I mean, that's silly. And so it seems to me that we need a very different paradigm for understanding what the forces of domination and fascism are in their more upgraded forms today.
Well, Henry, along those lines, the great German playwright and political theorist Bertolt Brecht, who lived in Germany during Hitler's reign, asked in 1935, quote, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" Unquote. What do you think about that?
I love that quote. And as a matter of fact, I've used it many times. And I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I think the end point of capitalism is fascism. The mobilization of misery, the mobilization of poverty, the most staggering poverty, the motivation of enormous inequities across a whole range of issues are so threatening and so endemic to a system that prioritizes human profit over social needs, over human needs, that we've arrived at an endpoint where, as I said earlier, it no longer can justify itself. And now, basically, it reveals what its underlying, I would think, identity is all about, which is basically fascism. You know, you do everything you can to deny the will of the people, crush dissent, mobilize a language that's in which anybody who opposes and wants to make power accountable is defined as an enemy, and do everything you can to basically engineer the forces of repression, while at the same time claiming that they're symbolic with the forces of democracy. Democracy and capitalism are not the same thing. And I think that at the core of Brecht's argument is precisely that, and that the endpoint of capitalism is what we're seeing today, the practical death of the planet, staggering inequality, massive misery, increasing forms of repression. You know, Marjorie, is better than anyone. I mean, when organizations like Freedom House and the Economist Intelligence Unit claim that democracy is receding all over the world, that's not because of the rise of simply strongmen. That's because of the rise of capitalism, which has engineered massive misery that's then transformed into authoritarian, anti-democratic tendencies in politics.
How do you fight fascism? What should we be doing, advocating, and doing? Is it helpful to rely on the Democratic Party? Why have they been unable to deliver on social programs like Build Back Better or a ban on assault weapons or raising the minimum wage or ensuring the right of a woman to control her own body or health care for all or canceling student debt, reducing the military budget, protecting the environment, and making us more secure from nuclear war? How do you fight that? How do you fight this fascist trend?
I think there are a couple of issues. I mean, first, in terms of the question of mass consciousness. You know, Marx is only partly right when he said the point is not to interpret the world, but to change it, meaning that you can't interpret and change anything unless you can understand it. So it seems to me you need a mass campaign to wake people up to how power works and what it's doing, and then you need to provide a language that they can inhabit in some fundamental way and recognize not only their own problems, but what it would take to basically address those problems collectively. That's one issue. The second issue is it seems to me that, you know, we've got to address in some fundamental way what it means to be able to get people to fight the worst ideological horrors of neoliberalism, and that is that we've got to be able to translate individual issues into broader systemic considerations. That's one of the most powerful ideologies that neoliberalism works against. And it does that by individualizing everything. All problems are individual. And so if all problems are individual, there's no way to address systemic considerations. Thirdly, it seems to me we've got to build a mass social movement outside of the two parties, both in terms of their ability to educate people, to offer what Vaclav Havel once called parallel polises or different spaces of resistance. And we've got to be able to build institutions to sustain those, to be able to work towards, in some fundamental way, a socialist democracy. Now, to go back to the Democratic Party and the first question that you mentioned, Michael, my feeling is there are a lot of people who say just throw the Democratic Party out the window. I say that's nonsense. I say you should do everything you can within that party to modify it and change it, not because it's the answer to solving our problems, but to push it towards at least being able to address some problems that people are dealing with immediately. For instance, the child tax law that was just not renewed. At the same time, we need to build an anti-capitalist movement that says, no, you know, that's about reform, and we will implement some reforms in the most immediate sense, but in the long sense, we really need something else. We need fundamental change, and that's not going to happen with the Democratic Party, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think it's we're for reforms. The question is, how do you fight for reforms?
How can people follow your work?
I mean, you know, how can they follow my work? I mean, I have a website, henryagiroux.com, in which I post almost all of my work. And I write for Truthout, I write for Counterpunch, I write for a number of places. And I think that in that sense, they can follow it through the social media. And I have a Twitter account. I do like you do, Marjorie. You know, I try to find those spaces where the stuff is available and accessible, but I do everything I can to post it So people can actually have access to it if they want to, if they can't engage it immediately.
Well, Henry, we're just delighted to have had you on Law and Disorder. You have an analysis that no one else has in this day and age, and it's so important for our listeners to hear that and put what's happening in this country in the real context of capitalism, anti-fascism, etc. So thanks so much.
G-I-R-O-U-X, Henry Giroux. Henry, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It's always an honor to be on your program. Thank you so much for asking all the right questions.
Thanks so much, Henry.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined now by Holly McGuigan, a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. Holly teaches at the Comparative Criminal Justice Clinic at NYU. She serves on the boards of directors at the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women and the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Holly is a past co-president of the Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, which is the largest membership organization of law professors in the United States. She's about to be honored by SALT in January as a great law teacher. Holly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Holly, you had a kind of a career switch because I think you were studying medieval literature, English literature, and then wound up in law school. Tell us about that.
Well, I was doing medieval history, actually, and I was at Berkeley, and it was 1967, and Oakland stopped the draft. Well, and I was still interested in medieval history, but I got very interested in the anti-war politics. I'd been interested in anti-racism politics before, but I always thought I could do my main intellectual love and my political love simultaneously. They didn't have to be the same. And I hated lawyers. I really hated lawyers. They were boring. They talked about themselves all the time. They only had stories about their cases and how great they were. And they would never post bail when people got arrested. So I had, like, very little use for lawyers. But I went to a meeting. I had moved to Santa Cruz from Berkeley. And I was at a meeting planning the People's Park demonstrations in 68 in California. And this guy takes the microphone and starts reading. And there's another guy in the back of the room who starts ululating. It's like right out of Battle of Algiers. It's unbelievable.
What's ululating mean? That's a big word for someone like me.
It's like making a sound that I can't make, but it's like making a kind of keening, howling, keening, wonderful sound. And he came running up to the mic and grabbed the mic and said, every time a suit tries to read you something, stop them. There's all these surveillance cameras here.
What's a suit? He's like got, a lawyer wearing
like
a suit?
Like a person wearing a suit. And he says, there's all these surveillance cameras. They all know you're here. This means this. What he's reading is a John and Jane Doe injunction against the march on People's Park. They've got cameras. They can every one of you is in criminal contempt if you now do the march, if you let him finish reading the injunction. Now, just don't ever let anybody. Just shriek, yell, do whatever sound you want to make. I thought that was so cool. That was the best. The most useful thing I'd ever seen a lawyer do in my life. So I went home. My fiancé was applying to law schools, despite my complaints. You're much too nice a person to go to law school. You shouldn't go to law school. And I was applying to history PhD programs. So I went home and I said, give me every application you haven't filled out. And I took it to a copy shop and I made copies. And so I applied to every law school whose application he hadn't finished. We were right up against the deadline.
Great way to select the law schools.
It's as good as any, you know.
Or a profession, for that matter.
Worked out well.
Which one accepted you?
We decided to go to the school that accepted us both and gave me the most money, because his family had money, but mine didn't. And that was the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which is where I stayed then for 17 years.
Well, let's talk about that, because you had the one of the preeminent constitutional and criminal defense law firms
Carey's, Rudofsky, and McGuigan in Philadelphia. And you were there during a time when Frank Rizzo was the police chief. And then the mayor. And we'll talk about Frank also. But I want to talk to you about your law practice and the kind of cases that you took there and how you developed into a criminal defense lawyer and a constitutional lawyer, because that leads right into your then becoming a teacher. But let's talk about the old days in Philly. How'd you start out?
I love that. Well, first, I started out as a public defender. I loved being a public defender. It was the beginning and end of everything I had hoped it would be. It was just great. And that's where I met David Rudofsky and David Carey's. They were then defenders when I was a student. And after they went out on their own, they invited me to join them. And I kept putting it off because I loved being a defender so much. I knew that working with them would be fabulous. I mean, there's no question. I just kept deferring it till finally they said, you know what? We can't wait any longer. We have to, like, go someplace else. What?
But let me ask you, I understand you loved being a public defender, but I've had other friends who've been public defenders. And, you know, it's not exactly wonderful job in certain ways because the people you meet have been so oppressed by the system and your chances of giving them anything meaningful is very hard. I mean, I've had friends who just said, I can't stand being in here. I can't go into the pens anymore with 50, you know, African Americans or Latinos that are just being harassed by this society. So how did you psychologically, I mean, I just, you know.
I don't know the answer to that, except that, first of all, in Philadelphia, there was much more actual litigation. Not just motion litigation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that here in New York City. But actual trials. Lots of trials. So you really had a shot at getting somebody off. And you had a sense, there was an analysis, that people were doing life on the installment plan. And that what you needed was to do what you could to kick them loose any particular time. And your clients understood that. There were limits to what you could do. The system wasn't the least bit fair. But people really appreciated the fact that there were lawyers at the Defender Association who were willing to give everything they had to get them out. And so it inspired you. You know what I mean? There was never a morning you got up and thought, why am I doing this? You know? And it was, in many ways, a difficult office to work in because instead of representing a client from beginning to end, which you didn't get to do until it was a major case. For the life on the installment plan cases, you know, the ordinary misdemeanors and low-level felonies, it was what's called vertical representation. You represented a room. But even so, you got to know people. So when you went to the jail, there were people who called your name and you knew their names. And it was, you know, it was a community in its own odd way. And it was very difficult for me to leave it. I found it very painful to leave.
But did you have any, how many years were you there, Holly?
I was there 3 years.
So you didn't really get to the highest level death penalty cases, right?
And there weren't then. There was no death penalty in Pennsylvania then. So I got to the
highest. It's a Quaker state, Michael.
Right.
No, there is now.
Yes, right. There is now, for sure. But you moved quite quickly if you worked hard in that office. So I was doing major felonies within a couple years. Yeah.
Let's go into private practice now.
Okay.
You go on with Carey's and Rudofsky, who I sat next to in law school because I'm Smith and he's R, and that's how it was arranged at NYU. But anyway, he goes to Philly. You wind up in Philly. They invite you to join the firm. It was one of those famous movement firms. Talk about what the three of you did.
Well, we did actually a lot of different things. David Carey's was very focused on constitutional litigation and government misconduct. Not to say he didn't do criminal stuff. He did the Camden 28, which was a big draft-resisting case in the late 70s. And Dave Carey's did a lot of police misconduct and some criminal defense. And my interest was more in the criminal defense. I liked that part better. I did police misconduct because the legal worker in that office, Jema Abdu, who then came to New York and was office staff for the National Office of the National Lawyers Guild, Jema was really a brilliant litigator. And she just gave me my marching orders and told me what to do. And so I did what she said. So it was a mix of things, and I did a lot of grand jury stuff in that time.
But that was political, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of cases, like...
Like the Patty Hearst grand jury was one of the first ones. It's where I met Bill Kunstler and Margie Ratner, now Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
Most people won't know what the Patty Hearst case was.
Well, it was. There was a grand jury convened. It was actually, it met all over the country, or several of them met, to investigate the alleged transportation of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army from California, where she had been captured, to
Pennsylvania by the
Symbionese Liberation Army.
It's a great story.
It's one of the great stories. At that time, I was involved with a man who was working for Mo Udall for president. And Mo Udall said something that annoyed me about the SLA. And Paul Tully calls me up and he says, let me just understand this. I don't get to come home until Mo goes on the network and says the SLA are my kind of people.
Again, the SLA is Symbionese Liberation Army. Right. Patty Hearst was, of course, an heir to the...
Right, the Hearst fortune. Right.
And she's kidnapped. She's, like, not necessarily part of anything.
No,
she's just kidnapped.
No. Kidnapped because she was a Hearst.
Right.
No, it was nothing she did. Nothing she did. So anyway, so these grand juries were convened, and I got a call from the Center for Constitutional Rights, about which you two know everything there is to know, and I bet your listeners do also. And I got a call just about being emergency counsel if there was a stay requested from a Harrisburg grand jury. And I was very excited because on the phone were Bill Kunstler and Rhonda Copeland and all these people whose names I knew but I didn't know. And they're explaining what they want me to do as if we were in the Second Circuit. It's a very New York thing. You assume the way things work in New York is the way they work everywhere. And that if everybody says that's not how they work, they think you just don't get it. So I was explaining the way the Third Circuit works. And I said, I need more. I need you to send me the papers. I need some reason to say why we have to wait for Bill and Doris and whoever else to get here. Because otherwise they'll just make me argue. Oh, no. I said, trust me. This is the Third Circuit. This is a different place. This is what they do. You file an emergency appeal, an application for a stay. They get a judge who's available. You have to go in. So it was apparently they hung up the phone then and said, we got a live one in Philadelphia. Let's rope her in. So that's how I got involved. And it was fun. We went all over. And we knew ultimately we were going to lose. You always lose. But you can cause a lot of delay and quite a bit of havoc if you're creative and energetic.
Were there witnesses you were representing in front of the grand jury?
Yeah. I represented Jay Weiner, who was then a sports writer who'd been blackballed because of his connection with the sports left. Remember Jack Scott and Mickey Scott in the Mexico Olympics?
And the African-Americans who raised their
fists. Exactly.
And they were involved with those people.
Yes. Right. So he was supposed to, after being graduated from college, go to local, I won't name it because I'm actually kind of fond of this newspaper, but a local newspaper that then withdrew the job offer. And he was working as a cook, actually not a bad cook at all, in a local vegetarian eatery in Philadelphia. Until the grand jury was over, he did some time. He was at Allenwood. But he got good advice from other clients of mine. So he
refused to testify.
He refused to testify and was held in contempt.
And the issue again was how the kidnapping and transportation.
He wouldn't give any information at all about what he may have known about what his friends were up to.
Because they're looking for Patty Hearst everywhere, right, at this
point.
Right.
At this point, they're looking for Patty Hearst or anybody who might have been involved in her kidnapping and transportation. This is after they had firebombed that house in Oakland. I mean, this was after a lot of tragedy. And so he ended up going to prison, but not for all that long, because one of the things you can do is then torture the judge until he lets him out. So we did that, and we got him out. So it could have been worse.
Let's talk about some more of your cases while you were doing criminal defense law in Philadelphia, because at that time Frank Rizzo was unfortunately around. Talk to us about him and the contention between your firm and his policies.
Well, he was a killer. I mean, there's no question. Under his tenure as commissioner of police and then as mayor, more people died as a result of police actions than before or since. I mean, one of the amazing things was that the next mayor, who was no great shakes, saw the number of deaths decrease by 33% just in the first 6 months of his time. It was a time when police were really green-lighted to do whatever they wanted and told it was the right thing to do. I don't mean to suggest that all the police started out homicidal. What I mean to suggest is this was a situation in which from the top down came the message, if you're a good cop, then you're going to take people out however you think you need to. And he himself was very sporty about it. You know, he liked to go out in a cummerbund in his night clothes with a nightstick stuck in his tuxedo cummerbund and round people up. I mean, and humiliate people. I mean,
look what he did to the Panthers.
Exactly. I was thinking about his invasion of the Black Panther Party headquarters in Philadelphia and his bringing out everybody who was found in there and forcing them to strip and stand naked on the street in the cold while he walks behind them wielding his nightstick. It was gross. It was horrible. It was really a very, very bad time.
So what did you folks at the law firm do litigation-wise in this situation?
We did a lot of criminal defense, of course, and a lot of litigation against the police tactics, and at all different levels, right? I mean, David and David did a lot of excessive force litigation, a lot of illegal search litigation. I tended to do litigation about people who were targeted more because of who they were, but together we did a lot. And the reality is, in that kind of situation, organizing is absolutely as important as litigating. And it was hard sometimes to keep your eye on the ball, you know what I mean, to remind yourselves that the litigation was one piece of a strategy, that unless people made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate this police violence, a judge's ruling or a jury's decision wasn't going to matter that much. But it's interesting. You get involved in litigation, and then you think, oh, this is it. This is it. This is the greatest. And people who were normally wearing thuggy clothes and feeling like they were wanted to show how tough they were are coming in little suits. And you say, Michael, what are you doing? He says, my mother's coming. You know, it's like, so it's important. And the lawyers play into that a lot. I mean, you really have to keep being mindful of the fact that you cannot ask people to take time away from organizing for litigation, that the litigation has to be just part of the whole strategy.
Now, did you develop any kind of specialty while you were working with Carrie Zrodowski and McGuigan?
Kind of by accident, I did, in a way. By the time we'd worked together for several years, I thought I knew about race and class bias in the courtroom as much as a white woman who was middle class could know. And then I got assigned to represent a woman who was accused of killing her abusive boyfriend. And I was just blown away by what happens when you add hatred of women to hatred of black people and hatred of poor people. It stunned me. It absolutely stunned me. I just had no idea. So, I mean, yes, I had some specialties before that. You know what I mean? I did some grand jury stuff, and I represented a lot of gay groups who were being harassed in various parts of the city, and but this thing just stunned me. And I called the judge who assigned me to this homicide to say, why me? Why did you assign me to this? And he said, oh, you just came up next, you know. It was like Philadelphia was very corrupt at that time, so he was one of the few judges who didn't demand money to be on the list to get a... Oh, I'm telling you, judges would go by me in the hall and say, oh, McGuigan, you didn't give me anything this Christmas, not even one lousy bottle. You're not getting any assignments.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Judges would do things like they'd open the drawer in their, chambers, and there'd be... you know, wads of bills, and they'd let you know what they wanted. Oh, I had one time I was litigating a motion to suppress, And the judge said, it's just about time for the lunch and recess. I bet between now and 2:15, you and your client will come up with 200 reasons why I should rule in his favor.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
That guy's cheap.
Stunning, right? So, well, it was a long time ago. And if you get 200 from everybody, right, you see what course. I mean? It's not that cheap.
That's amazing.
And 200 is within reach for a lot of people.
Those are amazing stories.
It was an incredible time. Oh, but the specialty.
Not
all
to
right.
solicit yeah. your specialty in bribing judges, but
I
your
did
specialty
not.
In
actually,
in law.
I was famous for not bribing them. So this guy gave me this case because I didn't bribe anybody. I was like known for. So he assigned me this case for no particular reason. And I went. This was the first time, to my knowledge, I now realize I had represented a lot of women who'd been victimized by intimate partner violence. I just didn't recognize, I didn't know, you know, I just didn't know. But this was the first time that I was aware that that was what was going on. So I went to this restaurant where what happened was he attacked her in a restaurant and pushed her back through the tables. She fell out of her shoes. She was knocking things off the tables as she went by, asking people for help. This is what she tells me, crying out for people to help her because he's strangling her and she can barely breathe. And they get to the back of the restaurant where there's a carving table, and she picked up a knife and stabbed him in the arm, meaning to get him just in the arm to make him stop. But because of the knife was very sharp. They were in a restaurant. And because of a birth defect or a birth, you know, anomaly, his heart was very close to the chest of his wall. It was far, so the knife pierced his heart and he died instantly on the spot. So I hire an investigator and I say, go to this place, it's around the same time, and see if there are any witnesses, because it's a neighborhood place and maybe there are people who go there every evening for an early dinner. And the investigator calls me and says, you have to come here. I go, I do not have to come here. I'm in court tomorrow. Excuse me, Joe. You're the expert investigator, and I'm the litigant. I do not. Trust me. You have to stop whatever you're doing, and you have to come here. So wow. I went there, and there were all these people in the restaurant, including a couple guys sitting at the bar. And Joe turns to them and says, tell her what you just told me. So they all look around, and one guy kind of collects himself and says, basically what she had said to me. He describes the scene. It starts out, remember cigarette machines? It starts out by the cigarette machine just inside the door. And he's saying, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And she's asking for help and nobody's helping. And,
wow.
And I say to him, why didn't you help her? And he says, we feel so bad about it now. But at the time, we didn't know they weren't married.
What?
So I thought, okay, what? This is a whole new world.
Right. It would have been wrong.
If they'd been married, it would have been okay.
Right. So I called the Women's Self-Defense Project, and I said, I really need help. I don't have any idea how to pick a jury. It's like, how do you pick a jury in a case? I mean, I'm used to picking juries in street crimes and the odd federal case, but it's mainly where the focus is on a person for reasons that are hideous, not because of reasons of anything they actually did. I have no idea. So it changed everything for me. So I developed something of a specialty in women who kill men. There is that. Although I should hasten to say that some of my best friends are men.
I appreciate that. You married one of ours.
Yes, I'm saying that my own personal husband is a very nice man. Right?
Although Michael did just pull his chair 2 feet farther from
he
Holland.
He did.
Now, what year was this? Because this is the very beginning of really the establishment of this.
Of the notion that women could claim self-defense and be reasonable
Mid-'80s, earlier?
No, late 70s.
Late 70s, okay.
It was. Liz Schneider was doing her work then in New York.
Right,
the Women's Self-Defense Project, the Center for Constitutional Rights was doing their work. So it was the start, for me, this started in the late 70s. And then in the early 80s, a group in Philadelphia called Women Against Abuse began working. And they did advocacy for battered women accused of crime. And it made a huge difference. It meant that we could collaborate with people who were really knowledgeable about the dynamics of intimate partner violence and about who to use as expert witnesses if you decided to use an expert witness, and about how to get in touch with them and what to do. It made a huge, huge difference.
Well, a remarkable experience. There's a number of other experiences while you were a criminal defense lawyer, but one that I know you mentioned to us was your argument in the Supreme Court.
Right.
But why don't you talk about that?
There was an issue running around about a person accused of crime and their right to cross-examine certain statements. And it was a question about the Sixth Amendment and the right to do it. And it was coming up in the Ninth Circuit, which is California, and in the Third Circuit, which is mainly Pennsylvania, although also Delaware and parts of New Jersey. So we were aware of all the litigation that was going on, and I was trying a case with this guy who was characterized by the newspapers as a rogue ex-cop who taught me a lot, actually. He taught me how to move, because he used to arrest what then we called second-story men, you know. And he taught me about how you get a double hefty garbage bag and you tie it with a square knot and you can carry almost anything. Since then, I've never moved any other way. I only move with garbage bags. They're very strong. They're very forgiving. So anyway, this guy was – I had represented him for years. He got in all kinds of entertaining trouble, and it was fun. You know, and mainly we won. And David Radofsky and I collaborated in a couple cases. Sometimes they went after him and they would search his house, and then David would sue them for the Fourth Amendment violation and earn enough money to pay our fee, and that just annoyed them so much. So in this case, we lost, and we appealed it to the Third Circuit, but appealed it having made a record that we knew satisfied the standards of the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit. Well, arguably that was a tactical error, because then when the government applied for cert, it was
cert being the way
a petition for certiorari is an application to the Supreme Court to hear an appeal, which they wouldn't hear as of right. And most criminal appeals, you have to petition for certiorari in order to get the Supremes to hear it. So they petitioned, and I say to my friends, we are dead in the water. This is it. They're going to grant cert in our case and not in one of the Ninth Circuit cases, and we are so dead. So by this time, David had stopped doing quite so much litigation. Dave Radofsky had done a lot of, had been doing, being the trainer for the Defender Association. And Dave Carries was moving into teaching. So I had started this other firm with Edmund Tyriac and Julie Shapiro and Leslie Engel. To do more litigation. So by the time this case went to the Supreme Court, that was the team. And I said to them, you know what? Once the cert petition was granted, which meant the Supreme Court was going to hear the appeal, it was over. It was totally over. So I said to them, we cannot let this take over our lives. It's true, it's the major leagues. On the other hand, we could write the best brief in history or submit no brief at all, and we're going to have Marshall and Brennan dissenting. We could do the best argument ever or fall down in a dead faint from panic, and we'll have Marshall and Brennan dissent. Let's not forget, this is six troglodytes and three dweebs, and it's just not going to work out for us. Our team is not going to win here. So we tried really hard not to get caught up in it, but it's, you know, there is a mystique about arguing in the Supreme Court. Well, you know, right? It's like a thing. So we ended up putting a whole lot of energy into the brief and a whole lot of energy into the argument. And in the end, do I need to say we had Marshall and Brennan dissenting? There was no choice. But anyway, it was entertaining. It was fun. It was kind of exciting. My mother came. And oh, actually, and this particular charge was a charge of manufacturing methamphetamine. So I practiced. I wanted to say to the justices, excuse me, Mr. Chief Justice, justices, could we not mention methamphetamine? My mother's here. She thinks I'm a civil rights lawyer.
this has been an extraordinary interview for me, and I think it will be for everybody who hears it. And so I hesitate to ask you, because you've already said it, what you would recommend to people about becoming lawyers. And of course, we're going way down in the number of lawyers that are applying to law school or people are applying to law school.
Lowest now since 1975.
Right, but what you said is really about putting yourself really in some way between the authorities and the state mm-hmm. and regular people. But is there any last thing in your thoughts about this, Holly?
I think you have to love gossip and love stories and love hearing stories and love hearing them more than once and figuring out how to tell that story, how to enable the person to tell her or his own story when he or she is able. Not everybody accused of crime is able to withstand the stress and actually tell it. But that's the main thing. And then you need to love codes. A lot of people who like law like crossword puzzles because they like filling in the blanks. A lot of people, as it turns out, who like law like medieval history, because a lot of it is about parsing little bits of information to try to see what the whole story is and tease it out. But I think it's really more than anything. It's about liking people and wanting to see what you can do to help them extricate themselves from a problem.
Let's talk about when you were held in contempt.
I was held in contempt several times. but the one case that keeps coming back to me is one where I was held in contempt by the trial level court for not disclosing the whereabouts of a client. The middle level appellate court reversed the contempt judgment with a great opinion. That's the only one to read, really. Commonwealth versus McGuigan, the appellate court. Then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the highest court, overturned that, but actually narrowed the judgment enough that we could live with it. But there were a couple things about it. One is it took so long. The prosecutors really did not care about getting the information. They really just wanted to bother me. It took forever. I mean, they took 3 years to file this and then 4 years to file that. Oh, it was ridiculous. They just wanted to keep it hanging over me. There were two terrific things about it. One was at the trial level, the prosecutor says after the judge holds me in contempt, he assessed a fine of $100 a day. You have to tell her to pay it to the probation department. The judge says, I'm not going to do that. Why waste their time? It's just a waste of paperwork. No, you have to. Otherwise, we can't hold her in an additional contempt for not having paid it. And the judge says, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to waste their time. I'm not going to waste my time. She's not going to pay a nickel, not a dime. Forget $100 a day. She's never going to pay. Right, McGuigan? Not one dime. So I loved that. I felt so proud.
Well, Holly, we so appreciate you being with us. And we call this segment Lawyers You'll Like, but in this case, it's Lawyers You'll Love. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear from a leading constitutional expert about the draft opinion of Samuel Alito that would overturn Roe v. Wade.
Erwin Chemerinsky is the most brilliant and most articulate person we've got on our side. Listen in.
We'll also talk with managing attorney Nicholas Arrivo of the Humane Society of the U.S. In 2014, Humane Society asked, what wild animals are we importing into our country? And 8 years later, we still don't know. Our guest claims the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is protecting corporations and trophy hunters.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am attorney and guest host Tamara Bettich, president of the National Lawyers Guild, New York City chapter.
In 1973, the Supreme Court held in Roe v. Wade that the Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion until the fetus becomes viable, that is, when it can survive outside the womb, which is about 23 weeks of pregnancy. Nearly 20 years later, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court reaffirmed the central holding of Roe and said restrictions that placed an undue burden on a woman's right to abortion were unconstitutional. In perhaps the most significant leak in the history of the Supreme Court, Politico published a draft opinion that Samuel Alito wrote in Dobbs versus Jack.
One of the objections to Roe versus Wade is not so much about abortion itself as it is about this entire enterprise of protecting fundamental rights having to do with family and bodily integrity. If that kind of objection prevails, then Roe will be the first domino that falls, but it will take with it the right to marriage, especially same-sex marriage, the right to use contraception, and other family and privacy rights.
That's Jennifer Hendricks, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jennifer Hendricks on Roe v. Wade and the Supreme Court. Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision which established the constitutional right to abortion, is under attack. The Supreme Court, with its super-conservative majority, is poised to overturn Roe. According to an editorial in Against the Current, poll after poll reveals that the right to abortion care actually has more popular support today than when Roe v. Wade was decided. If that right can be mutilated now, precedent and public opinion be damned, then no rights are secure from reactionary assault. For right-wing sharks, the editorial continues, getting rid of Roe is blood in the water. The New York Times estimates that more than 20 states are expected to ban or substantially restrict abortion if the Supreme Court permits it. However, some states, like Colorado, are going in the opposite direction, passing legislation legalizing the right to an abortion. To talk about these issues is Jennifer Hendricks. She's professor of law and co-director of the Juvenile and Family Law Program at the University of Colorado. She's the author of the essay Abortion Rights and the Supreme Court, A Tale of Three Wedges. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder on February 24th.
Everyone here likely knows that last spring, the Supreme Court granted cert in a case designed as a vehicle for overruling Roe versus Wade. That case is called Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. The oral argument in December confirmed the likely outcome, with some lingering questions over how explicit the court will be in the overruling and what other implications the decision might have. My plan here is to take a look back at abortion law over the last 50 years to get a sense of where it has left us as we stand on the threshold of this new era. I'll offer a description of the arc of the Supreme Court's abortion jurisprudence in terms of what I've called three wedges, wedges that pry the pregnant woman apart from first her fetus, second her doctor, and third her community. The first two wedges, separating the woman from her fetus and her doctor, have each taken a turn as the primary justification for restrictions on abortion rights in the law. Roe itself founded abortion rights on the first wedge as a theory for restricting them, the concept of a state interest in the fetus as an entity distinct from the pregnant woman. As public opinion shifted in favor of women seeking abortions, the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision out of Pennsylvania in 1992 shifted to a new rationale for restrictions, distrust of the abortion provider from whom the woman needed to be protected. That's the second one.